I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, bitch, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, on the line, I've got Matthew Ho. He famously was a whistleblower in the war in Afghanistan when he was working for the State Department. Before that, he was a Marine in Iraq War II, and he blew the whistle in 2009, trying to prevent Obama's useless surge before it was too late. And you can read all about him in the Washington Post and in my book, Fool's Errand. And we ran as a spotlight the other day this great piece that he wrote for Counterpunch. We reran it at antiwar.com. Time for peace in Afghanistan and an end to the lies. Welcome back to the show, Matthew. How you doing, man?
Good, Scott. Thanks for having me on. And thanks for running my piece again. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got to tell you, man, this is the best thing about Afghanistan I've read in a long time. This is really great. And I mean, not that it surprised me or whatever, because you always write really great stuff about Afghanistan, but just it really stands in comparison to virtually everything else out there, including some stuff I've been trying to write lately. You know, you really know this subject as well as any critic. So, you know, let's say that, you know, give us a 101 here. Say you're talking to my right-wing uncle. Neither of my uncles are right-wing. But say you're talking to my right-wing uncle who has supported this war all along and he can't get it through his thick skull, but now's your chance. He's finally listening.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that what trying to get across in the essay and when you try and get across to people is, you know, use what's inside your skull. You know, does any of what you've been told the last 17 years make sense to you? Haven't you heard all these same arguments over and over again? And I think that was what I was trying to get across in this right. essay.
Well, that's the thing. It's the 17 years, right? That's why everybody's right-wing uncle is finally willing to listen to you.
Yeah.
Is because they're looking at their watch going, how can this be real? It's almost 2020.
Exactly. And the same thing that, like, so the right-wing uncle or your left-wing cousin, I mean, what they hear on Fox News or what they hear on MSNBC, it's the same thing that's been said year after year. You know, the retired generals who go on and push for the war or whoever is, you know, saying that we it's just a matter of more time and more troops, or we've improved our tactics, you know, and it's just give it some more time. They've been saying that year after year. I remember, you know, Danny Davis and I, and, you know, Danny's a similar, you know, great friend of your show, as well as, you know, what he did in 2012, speaking out against the war while he was still an army officer. You know, I remember Danny and I co-authored a piece back in 2010 where we listed what all the different generals who had been charged of the war had said about the war, going back to Dave Barno back in like 04 or 05. And year after year, the generals were saying the same thing. And it was came down to, we just need some more troops and some more time, and this thing will be wrapped up next year. Hmm. And that is what we have heard year after year. And so, again, yeah, when you're talking about what do you say to people who still are giving this war a chance, it's come on, you know, not just the evidence of this war, but the evidence of all the wars the U.S. has been in. You know, I mean, where do you point to the successful one? Where do you point to the one that says, like, yeah, the U.S. military is the greatest fighting force in the world? You know, where's the evidence of that? And then when it comes down to the evidence, the things that you could point to, and I think this is where, you know, with your book as well as with his essay, because your book is the same way. It's so well – your book, Scott, is so well sourced. And the sources that you used and the sources that I used are not from some kind of kooky alternative media opinion page, but rather they're either directly from U.S. military data or from, you know, I think probably who I linked to most in my essay was the New York Times. You know, so it's not you and I who are saying the evidence should be looked at and weigh this war on the evidence of it. And you're going to see the same themes repeat year after year, or that the war has been just getting worse every year. That data doesn't come from the mouths of Scott Wharton or Matt Ho. It comes from the, you know, evidence of the U.S. government until they stop publishing such evidence, you know, which they've done a number of times now, or from the pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post.
Yeah, I was actually afraid that this would be the criticism of my book was, wow, Horton can read the Washington Post and tell us what it said, you know, exactly just because right. So many of my footnotes were my dependent on them, you know.
Yeah, that's my essay as well. You know, I mean, if you go through all the links, it's like link after link back to the New York Times. You
and
know?
Now, by the way, for a critic who wants to maybe, you know, take that out of context, that's not because the Washington Post is on a jihad against this war. It's because everything that they say that coincides with what we say is essentially against interest. They're the lobby of the war party. And so Everything that they say that agrees with us is essentially an admission or them citing a general saying, well, I guess it's true. And now, so let me ask you about this, because when you talk about the, you know, the slogans, I'm saying the same thing year in, year out. Few more troops, a little more time, light at the end of the tunnel, about to turn a corner, another Freedman unit. Remember that from Iraq War II? Another 6 months, and then everything will be fine. When you are actually deployed over there, when you're working, at, you know, at the State Department at the highest level, talking with these generals and the other people in charge and all of this, is that the same level of ignorance and unreality that they're actually planning the war around? Like, for example, you know, one of the things about the war, I mean, the main thing about the war, essentially, as we've talked about before, is the Pashtun tribal population, they don't really have any other political representation but the Taliban. Doesn't mean the Taliban are their very favorite. They don't really have anyone else to represent them. And it's essentially this giant plurality of the country, 40%, not a majority, but still the biggest single plurality, against an alliance of everybody else who are about 20% each, and how this is, you know, unmovable stone, right? This is a thing, this is something that is not going to change. It can't be changed. And when you hear them talk about it, they just talk about, well, we're going to fight some more. They don't ever say something about how, well, what we're going to do is we're going to give the people of the South and East such an interest in what's going on in Kabul that they're going to love it now, or any kind of thing that actually describes what they're up against. Instead, everything is spoken about as though it's simply a matter of military tactics, maybe not even strategy, but just tactics. We need to use more planes here and less helicopters there, this kind of garbage, you know, sending some Marines and less Army, or, you know, this kind of deal, without ever really confronting the questions. So, but, you know, there's got to be a disconnect, right, between what they say to the press and what they say behind closed doors, so... Are they really this out of touch with the actual situation that they're in? The leaders, the generals in charge, are they that off topic when it comes to, you know, planning around the answers to the correct questions?
Yeah, no. I think you can look at it in two ways. One is, and since I did both, I'll talk to both. When you're over there with the military, you know, when I was over there as a Marine officer in Iraq, you divorce yourself from the bigger picture and you look at keeping your, in my case, my Marines and sailors safe. And you don't think about the bigger picture, even though, because you don't want to open that door. And so you just focus on what's immediately in front of you and immediately around you. And these guys who go over there year after year with the military, that's what I believe most of them do. Of course, you get some true believers, you know, you get some who are, dissenting while they're over there. You know, some who are, you know, like say like Danny Davis or Danny Sergison, you know, who come back and then speak out about it. Those are, you know, incredibly few in numbers. But I think most of the men and women who are there in uniform, at least the ones who are out on the ground and seeing the realities of the war, seeing just like you said, Scott, with the, say the case with the Taliban, you know, the Pashtun population of Afghanistan, the two choices they have are the Taliban or the U.S. or NATO occupiers who are propping up a predatory, corrupt, unrepresentative government composed of their traditional rivals. You know, so as you said, like, what choice do they have? They don't have a choice to the Pashtun people of the South and the East. You know, they're going to support the Taliban. That's the only thing they can do, because who is going to support the foreign occupier? So I think that's what you get with those in uniform. Now, for the civilians who are over there, for the State Department, what I saw and what I still believe is the case is that most State Department officials, besides the ones who have in their head that they're going to become the next Lawrence of Arabia, that they're going to become they read all the David Kilcullen books or John Nagle books, right? And they believe that stuff. And mostly, I feel like the true believers who are in military uniforms who are over there, those are mainly, I think, intelligence folks, folks who never leave the bases, folks who, you know, never actually get out and see the reality of the war, who the reality of war to them is the confirmation bias they receive by what they read on the base all day. And I think that's the case, say, with the CIA. CIA officers who consistently go over there and work over there, I found have that confirmation bias, that they keep reading the things over and over again that tell them that Al-Qaeda is prevalent throughout the Taliban. Well, that's coming from paid sources and is totally belied by any real evidence. But for, I think for State Department folks, what I found, the people who occupy the embassy, is that they're only there for a year. And even in that year's time, they're eligible to take leave three times, you know, so they're able to get away a lot. And then they never have to go back. And that's what I kind of found with a lot of my civilian counterparts, was they had the capacity to understand that the war was inherently wrong, inherently unwinnable, inherently immoral, but they were doing their duty. They had signed up to be foreign service officers or civil servants, and that they were going to do as they were ordered to, basically, and they could gut it out for a year, and then they never have to touch this again, that they would go on to the next assignment in Brasilia or to Paris or Ottawa or back to Washington, D.C. or wherever they were going, and they could leave this all behind them. So I think that's basically how so many men and women have gotten through these wars without the full knowledge of how just wrong, immoral, unwinnable they are. Yeah. Now, a lot of men and women can't, you know, the VA is, you know, look at the VA reports, and certainly we've had, if you look at the VA numbers, roughly about 9,000, approximately 9,000 Iraq and Afghan war veterans kill themselves after coming home. So, you know, there is that pressure on a lot of men and women that takes its toll. It's a real head scratcher. How do people keep going over and over and over again to these things or keep supporting it? But there's a lot of different reasons. And one of the reasons I get into in the essay is the golden handcuffs, that when the men and women get to a level where they've seen enough of it, and it also too that they've got enough experience to understand that this war is unwinnable, immoral, tragic, etc., they're financially tied into the military or into the U.S. government. They're making $120,000, $130,000 a year all told. What are they going to do? They're going to leave as a, you know, a senior captain or a major or a boot lieutenant colonel, and head out into quote the real world, unquote, to do what? Work for the defense industry as a contractor, or what? Go to work at Starbucks? You know, I mean, so the golden handcuffs are also very, very real, mm-hmm. and that blinds people to, but it allows people to put blinders on and keep moving forward.
Are you a libertarian? You run an IT business? Well, then you have to read No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. No Dev, No Ops, No IT. It's how to run your computer company like a libertarian should. And you know what? This is, in a sense, it's a side point. But you know what? I spent my entire life watching TV, watching sports, and seeing all of the military commercials always being framed, not so much around defending your country from foreign enemies, but this is how a boy becomes a man. This is how someone whose parents don't have degrees can grow up to get a degree and a real job. And some of the commercials even were just blatantly racist, where they're just like, are you black or a Mexican? You could never be a helicopter repairman unless you join the military first. Go to army.gov or whatever. I mean, they're just as blatant about it as could be. But then that's the whole sales point, is that you are going to learn skills that are going to make you, give you an advantage in the private market as soon as you get out, when that just couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, maybe in some special circumstances, but overall, it's like you're saying, you know, certainly not at competitive rates. Maybe they could go to college, but get out of the Army, they find that they have a lot of skills for being in the Army and not a lot of skills for engaging in business whatsoever. Why would they learn business in the Army, you know, other than contracting, which is different, but.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can tell you even too, I was a combat engineer in the Marine Corps. And I mean, mainly we did demolitions and explosives and looked for IEDs and stuff like that. But also too, we did, you know, construction engineering to a degree. Not anything on my degree, not anything particularly sophisticated, but I do have I had a very solid background in program management and project management, and I was trained in all that. And, you know, I could figure out how many dump trucks do you need to do move X amount of fill, you know, I mean, like all that stuff I knew how to do. The thing about it though, and then in terms of fleet maintenance, I had, at one point in my life, I had over 100 pieces of rolling stock, 100 different vehicles that were underneath me, you know, so all the maintenance, right, all the hazardous material requirements, all the how do you handle petroleum, oil, and lubricants, all that kind of stuff, right, you know, but the military doesn't give you, and they were going to change this, and I don't know if they did, but at this point, up until several years ago, they still weren't. They don't give you the certificates, or they don't give you what's required to just transition out to the civilian world. So you could be, you could say join the Army, and you could drive a bus in the Army all 3.5 years of your contract, right? Drive a regular bus. You drive the base band around, the Fort Jackson band around for 3.5 years. You come out of the Army, you don't have that bus driver license to get a job with Greyhound. You don't have what the civilian world wants or requires to transition into the civilian counterpart of your work experience. Now, certainly if you're in the infantry or artillery or whatever, yeah, nothing's going to translate, right? But there are a lot of things in the, like you said, helicopter repairman, right? You know, so you can't go and get a job with an aircraft company straight out because you don't have the same certifications. And all these certifications are just pieces of paper. But up until – and they were going to fix this, but I don't know if they did or not. Congress was going to do it because the military sure as hell wasn't going to do it. So what they do is they tell you this. They bring you in. They train you at these things. But then they don't give you the pieces of paper that are necessary for you to find that type of employment when you come out of the military. So it really is. It's very cynical. And it's very crass and very, you know, it's cheating, basically. But it's certainly, yeah, the idea that somehow the military is a benevolent organization that is going to that has the best interests of its recruits behind it, or the best interests in overall serving society by bringing in young men and women and giving back to them. You know, adults who are able to do all these different jobs. Yeah, it is you know, a recruiting ploy that comes from you know, the different advertising firms that the Pentagon hires on Madison Avenue.
Now, I guess one thing they could say is, well, we instill in these young men and women a can-do, get up at 5 a.m. type of an attitude, which brings us back to Afghanistan for a minute here, because, you know, this, it makes sense that any general or lieutenant colonel or whoever is going to tell his boss that, yes, sir, can do, because, yeah, after all, they can put firepower on targets, as they like to say. And so from their point of view, they can win. They've never lost a battle to the Taliban. Okay, maybe one and almost two, but otherwise, they never, you know, lost a battle. How can they get run out of a country by people they've never lost a battle to? And so it makes sense that from now on, if the war lasts another 70 years, you would have generals saying, hey, man, just unleash me. We can take them. And they don't seem to ever understand or ask the question. They obviously have an interest, just like they don't have an interest in training you to leave the army and go use your skills somewhere else. They don't have an interest in understanding why what they're doing can't work. You ask the Marines to go back to the Helmand province and they go, all right, back to Helmand. Just like a few years ago, look at us now. And then, and they're not even mad. They just go, okay, this is how it's supposed to be, I guess. So that's the whole deal, right, is you need people, you need civilians to put the brakes on that. Because if you ask the military, they'll just keep eating their own ice cream cone from here into eternity.
That's exactly right. And I remember having this conversation when I resigned from my post in Afghanistan. I had to go see Ambassador Eikenberry. And Carl Eikenberry, who was the ambassador to Afghanistan at the time, had been the three-star general that had been in charge of Afghanistan for the U.S. military for a couple of years prior to that. And I remember Ambassador Eikenberry saying exactly that to me, you know, and his frustration with Hillary Clinton at that point came out as well, too, because both him and Holbrooke have been shut down by Clinton in terms of bringing up any type of opposition to escalating the war. But he said exactly that. He said, yeah, the military, you know, you take one hill and then you take the next hill, you know, I mean, and you keep going. There's nothing about the military that, as you said, Scott, is going to self-regulate itself. It's not supposed to do that. It's not designed for that. And that's why we have this system of civilian control. I mean, and it's nothing new. They knew this 250, 300 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
TV says that, oh my God, can you believe that Trump is acting in defiance of the generals? Well, but General Votel has testified that he disagrees with the president and that the president's assessment of the reality and what should be done in policy is wrong. And so, how dangerous is this president that he is totally drawn outside of the lines prescribed to him by his generals?
Yeah, you know, you see that. And I was just actually just reminded, you know, as a really great example of the opposite occurring, you know, one of the, I guess, maybe the exception that proves the rule, right? Where if you go back and you look at what the various five-star and four-star generals said in World War II about dropping the atomic bombs and how it wasn't militarily necessary and Japan was already surrendering and et cetera, et cetera. There was no need to use those weapons and Truman went ahead and did so. You know, I think that's the exception that proves the rule. And otherwise, I think you're hard pressed to find an example where the civilian authorities did not execute wise, or, you know, I mean, this is the argument that goes back to when Trump came in the office, why it was so dangerous for him to have generals throughout the White House. You know, so when Trump comes in, he puts McMaster as National Security Advisor, he puts Kelly as Chief of Staff, and he puts Mattis as Secretary of Defense. And what you have there is you have military men who only think in the manner of victory, and particularly with Kelly and Mattis, military men who think of themselves as some kind of modern-day legionnaires. You know, you look at their writings, you look at their speeches, and they really see the world as a through a Manichaean lens, that their duty is to guard the Republic from the barbarians at the gates, you know. But you don't have – they're not politicians. They're not civilians. They're not going to weigh the political costs or societal costs of military action. So as you said, Scott, those breaks aren't there. You know, I mean, and that's the purposes of having civilian control, is because the military is not going to stop. They're going to keep going. And that's the real danger as we get into year 18 of these endless wars, and as the wars keep expanding. I mean, God, we have more troops getting into contact or into combat in Africa now than we do in the Middle East. You know, I think over the last several years, we've seen, you know, according to, you know, Nick Turse, you know, and the Brown University Cost of Wars Project, you know, we've seen our troops have been killing or being killed in, you know, 9 different countries, or maybe even 10 different countries in Africa. While in the greater Middle East Muslim world that we're used to seeing our soldiers fighting in, the number is 7, right? So it's really something that, you know, the other day, and thank God for what you guys do at Anti-War and Jason Ditz, because I know these things, you know, just Jason reported the other day, or, you know, that the U.S. is sending a destroyer, you know, right next to Russian waters in the Black Sea, because the U.S. admiral who was quoted about this was irritated by the fact that the Russians had seized Ukrainian naval vessels that had gone into Russian sea space or water space or territory. And because this admiral is irritated, we're sending a destroyer to poke the bear, basically. Yeah, I mean, so this is what they're going to do. And if we don't have civilian control, civilians who would say the risk is unacceptable, the political risk, the societal risk, whatever, then yeah, they're going to keep doing it.
Hey guys, check out thebumpersticker.com and libertystickers.com. I created the company way back when, but I sold it to Rick McGinnis, and he's done such a great job keeping it going since then. They do great custom work for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. And get anti-government propaganda for the back of your truck at libertystickers.com. Yeah, now, so there's so many different things I want to ask you about. I guess, first of all, back to just the situation on the ground in Afghanistan for a minute here. You brought up earlier these claims that Al-Qaeda is embedded with the Taliban. Now, we've heard this all along, except that they kind of gave it up after sort of later Obama years. I think Panetta said, well, you know, there might be 50. And at that point, even regular, you know, CJ Chivers and whoever, regular reporters started looking around and saying, hey, I ain't seen any Arabs in 10 years around here. I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about. But actually, just what, 6 weeks ago, there were some battles out in Herat in western Afghanistan. And then they said, oh, and they were fighting against Al-Qaeda guys, too. But then they didn't elaborate at all. They didn't say, yeah, they killed 6 Egyptians, old friends of Osama and Zawahiri. Nothing like that. They just claimed it. I was wondering if you know anything about that at all, if you put any stock in that whatsoever, that the Taliban are fighting with Osama's old friends there.
I don't put any stock in that. And there's so many different ways to, you know, unpack it. One, I remember in Afghanistan one time, I came across 2 of the Afghans that I worked with. And walking up to him, and they were arguing about something or bickering about something. And then one of them turned to me and he said, he's Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
Give me money. You know, I mean, like that, right? I mean, like, so it's certainly, if I'm the Afghan government, I am going to report to the U.S. government that they found Al-Qaeda, foreign fighters, whatever, all the time. And if I'm the U.S. government, I'm going to tell the press that, because there are those within the U.S. government who don't want these wars to end. And then if I'm in her, and then particularly if you want to extend it further, because we've seen that this week now, right, where where Trump and the government is trying to tie Iran and Al-Qaeda together, then certainly let's report that there are Al-Qaeda fighters in Western Afghanistan along the Iranian border, you know, and now that they're not getting safe haven from Pakistan anymore, the Al-Qaeda guys are getting safe haven from Iran. You know, if you're going to justify a war, yeah, you need that bloody shirt to justify it. You need to, you know, raise the images of people jumping out of the Twin Towers, you know, in order to get people behind you. It's, you know, they kept saying for year after year there were fewer than 100 Al-Qaeda fighters left in Afghanistan. And that number was just, I think, basically a made-up number to try and give a light at the end of the tunnel. I remember first hearing that from Jim Jones, who was a national security advisor in 2009. And I had certainly not seen anything in this when I was there in the east or the south that led me to believe, intelligence-wise, you know, top secret intelligence, that there was anything to do with Al-Qaeda. You know, I mean, there, and even too, remember when we killed bin Laden in 2011, the Taliban said, hey, you know, he fought against the Americans, so we, you know, and he fought against the Soviets, so we, you know, we honor him and we respect him, and he was a you know, an ally, but we're fighting in Afghanistan. Our fight has nothing to do with him. I mean, their statement was very clear about how there was not, and they were going to keep fighting the Americans, not to revenge bin Laden, but because the Americans were in Afghanistan. Right. I mean, and this has been over and over again. And I think any fair commentators who look at the evidence of what the Al-Qaeda-Taliban relationship was in 2001 will say that it was convoluted, complicated, difficult. There's never been any evidence that I know of that has been like that smoking gun that said, oh yeah, the Al-Qaeda told the Taliban about the attacks, the 9/11 attacks. I mean, there's never been any evidence of that. And it certainly seems to me, from everything I know, that at that point, Al-Qaeda was just, I mean, I'm sorry, the Taliban had just had enough of Al-Qaeda and were trying to figure out a way to deal with them. Bin Laden was basically under house arrest at that point in Kandahar. Yeah. And
there's a brilliant book about this by Strick and Lynn Schotten, Van Lynn Schotten, something like that.
Alex Strick.
Alex Strick and it's called The Enemy We Created. And it's absolutely perfect. Yeah, hey, for anyone who's interested in that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, and the craziest thing, one of the things that I would just, if you really want to dumbfound people about the whole insanity of the war, is that the guy who actually brought bin Laden to Afghanistan in 1996, when Sudan kicks him and his followers, all of whom at that point in 1996, they could all fit on one plane. That's how big Al-Qaeda was at that point, you know, and they probably all had a seat between themselves, you know. Was a guy named Abdul Saif. And Abu Sayyaf brings bin Laden to Jalalabad about 4 or 5 months before the Taliban captured Jalalabad. So the Taliban basically kind of inherit bin Laden. But Abu Sayyaf, the guy's still in the Afghan parliament. The guy who brought bin Laden, he's run for president in Afghanistan. I mean, like, and this is the guy that, if you're familiar with the Philippines, Abu Sayyaf, the terror group in the Philippines, this is the guy that they're named after.
Really?
This guy is.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He is still, as of a couple of years ago, maybe he's not now, maybe, but they haven't even announced a result, as far as I know, from the November parliamentary elections. So, no, I can't see why he would. But yeah, so the guy who actually brought bin Laden to Afghanistan, Abdul Saif, and this is in the 9/11 report. I mean, this is not, as we kind of were talking about originally, Scott, this is not stuff that Matt Ho is just spouting because he read it in some, you know, far left rag. No, this is what the U.S. government reported.
Hey, there's some great journalism going on in some far left rags when it comes to this stuff.
Oh, there is. But
that's,
you know, but
that's why
but
I read you a lot of times. But no, I hear you. I'm just joking. I mean,
like you're saying for people who discount this,
sure.
The sources for this are the U.S. government themselves. You know, yeah. I mean. And that's for the whole insanity of this war.
All right, but now, so let me ask you about the safe haven for the Islamic State, because, you know, and I talk about this in the book. There's some good articles about how what we call ISIS, Khorasan, ISIS-K, or this kind of thing, they're essentially Pakistani Taliban who were, I like this, Pakistani fighters who were fleeing the Obama-backed Pakistani military onslaught in the Swat Valley in 2010. And to them, Afghanistan was safe haven on the other side of the border. So they were hiding in Afghanistan as refugees. And then, according to this one story, they lived in this village in Nangarhar for like almost a year. And then one day they just raised up all their flags and said, by the way, this village is ours now, and we're your new leaders, and you'll bow down, and took over the place. But so, you know, at least they were born as still an offshoot of a local Pashtun insurgency, and one that, you know, glommed onto the branding of the Islamic State back when such a thing existed a couple of years ago. But that gives the safe haven myth a whole new lease on life. And then all they have to do, as they have said in the last couple of weeks, is sprinkle a few Chechens or a few Syrians and say, see, we claim that there are a few Syrians there. Therefore, it's essentially Baghdadi's organization, and we can't back down now.
Yeah, the Afghan analyst network, which, you know, as you know, they just do great work, you know, and some of those folks are Afghans, of course, but the West, the non-Afghans who are involved in that organization have been in Afghanistan for decades. But anyway, they're reporting on, how the Islamic State in Khorasan, you know, it goes a step further in that it was the CIA and the Afghan NDS, which is a version of the Afghan intelligence service.
Uh-huh.
They helped bring these guys to Afghanistan with the idea of utilizing them to split and fracture the Taliban.
Right.
That they were going to bring in these other guys, and that these guys were going to kind of raise hell within the ranks and cause problems. And then that effort, of course, the next CIA station chief or whoever who came in said, we're not going to do that anymore. They stopped funding for that. And then these guys are left in Afghanistan, like you said, Scott, in a village in Nangarhar. And so, yeah, they decide to raise the black banner of the Islamic State. And very savvy on their part, right? Because that gets them on the front page of the Washington Post and the New York Times and gets them all kinds of attention, when the reality is that, yeah, they're just a bunch of guys from, you know, next door with Kalashnikovs. Nothing really special about them.
Yeah. Oh, the one more part of that, because that's actually where I got all my stuff from for the book, is from that Afghan analyst's website where they wrote all about that. And one more small aspect of that is they also wanted to use them for terrorist attacks inside Pakistan as a tit for tat for the Pakistanis backing the Afghan Taliban against them. And they want to do a mirror image of that and teach them a lesson by just outright backing terrorist attacks against their allies in the Pakistani government.
Yeah, it's you can't make this stuff up, you know.
Crazy,
you really just can't make this stuff up.
Sorry, hold on just one second. Hey, you guys, check out Kesslin Runs. It's a great new dystopian novel about the very near future by our friend Charles Featherstone. I think you'll really like it. Check it out. It's on Amazon.com right now. Kesslin Runs. All right, now, so here's the thing. The Islamic State really is defeated. Whether you want to give credit to MARSOC and the Air Force or the Shiite militias backed by Iran, or, you know, the Kurdish YPG, or a combination of all of these things. The Islamic State, such as it was, is no more in Iraq or in Syria. There's still a low-level insurgency in Iraq. Pretty much nothing left in, at least, eastern Syria when it comes to the Islamic State fight. There's still Al-Qaeda guys there. But anyway, when they leave Eastern Syria, there's a compelling narrative that the war is over. Yeah, Raqqa is liberated, and the Syrian Arab Army and the Kurds are going to divvy up this land among themselves, and there's no room for the Islamic State between them, and so the fight's fought, and if the Institute for the Study of War wants to cry about it, it doesn't matter. They don't really have much of a point. Afghanistan, however, and as we talked about, yeah, it is already 2019, so we've heard this before, and yet, isn't it true that there remains hell to pay in Afghanistan after America stops, whether now or whether 10 years from now, when America stops backing that government in Kabul and propping up and training and providing air cover for that army, and that government falls apart, isn't it likely that the Taliban, I don't know, you know, how good the cinematography is going to be, or, you know, exactly how they're going to do, if they're going to march right into Kabul, if they're going to sneak in at night, or exactly how they're going to do it. But aren't they likely to take Kabul? Isn't there likely to be a further civil war as all the people that all the essentially the Quislings that America has propped up there, as their power falls back down closer to their natural levels of power in the country? And aren't the Taliban a bunch of savage suicide bombing bastards who are going to push their luck to the nth degree, just like always? And so don't we have years worth of told you so's by the war party saying, see, we told you if we left, something bad might happen, which is the way they'll frame it. And they won't admit that, yeah, but that's only because they lost the war. Right? But they'll just say, just like they blame Obama for leaving Iraq, not for backing jihad in Syria, leading to the rise of the Islamic State. They wanted him to do that, but for leaving Iraq so that the Islamic State could take not just Eastern Syria, but Western Iraq too. Now that was a big mess up and went too far, so they had to launch Iraq War 3 to correct that. But you understand what I'm saying. There's this narrative, never should have left Iraq, look at the consequences. And that's what they told Trump when they made him escalate in 2017. That, you know, we're just going to use the Iraq ISIS narrative against you, that you're surrendering to the terrorist enemy. So I don't know. I just figure, I wonder still, even after, you know, 17 and a half years and all of this, whether that's still too steep of a hill to climb for any politician to be the one on whose watch this thing all completely falls apart.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you go back to, you know, and say what you will about Bob Woodward or whatnot, I mean, but his books are very instructive. I mean, you go back to the one he wrote about Obama and the decision making behind the Afghan war. One of the things you notice in it is that, you know, and also too with his books about the Bush administration, he's giving away all kinds of classified information in there. I mean, literally stuff that if you worked with intelligence, you would cringe as you're reading it, because like that stuff's not supposed to be published. You know, this kind of information not supposed to be talked about, but Woodward was allowed to talk about it. But what you notice, particularly say with the Obama book, is that there's no discussion of the politics of the Afghan war when it comes to domestic public opinion. And what I mean by that is that while Woodward is in these high level, top secret meetings between Obama and the generals and Clinton and Gates and everyone else, there's reporting of that verbatim that's never disputed by the Obama administration. But there's no reporting on what David Axelrod or Rahm Emanuel or any of Obama's political lieutenants said about it. And I think that's exactly what you're looking at. The closest you get is when is in that book is when Petraeus would say this often to the media. You know, if the Taliban take Kandahar, you're going to have another 9/11. As if the planes that took down the World Trade Center took off from Kandahar International Airport. You know, I mean, just absolutely ludicrous. But there's not that, like you are saying, where the president is confronted with, look, Mr. President, if you pull out and there's another terror attack, they are going to nail this to you. And this is, I mean, this is not new, right? This goes back to, if you read David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest, you know, I mean, this is the crux of what Lyndon Johnson dealt with in the Vietnam War. This is why Johnson resigns basically in 68, you know, along a couple other reasons. But, you know, I mean, this, who lost China? The Democrats lost China, you know, and so the Democrats have to like fight the communists in Vietnam. And there is like just some really great, you know, Bill Moyers republished it in 2009. I remember the first time I actually read it. But of Johnson talking about this, knowing how the war in Vietnam couldn't be won, it was not a worthwhile war for young American boys to go and die in. But he said, if I don't do this, there are those men over, you know, in Capitol Hill who are going to crucify me for it. So, yeah, there is that political argument where the president doesn't want to seem weak. And now you have a more modern example of the who lost China, where Obama lost Iraq. Where, yeah, we're not going to talk about, let's not talk about how we were funding and supporting and helping the Islamic State just on the other side of the border in Syria. We're not going to bring that up. But, you know, Obama pulled the troops out of Iraq, and then Iraq fell just a couple years later. You know, it could also go the other way, too, because we all know about Nixon's decent interval with Vietnam, you know. Can an American president pull out of Afghanistan or Syria or whatnot, be assured that there'll be a decent interval so that he doesn't get blamed when everything falls apart? But yeah, there's going to be repercussions for the war. There's going to be repercussions for those who joined our side, who joined the occupiers. That happens in every war. But the idea that the Taliban are going to get on the road and march and take Kabul, I think one is belied by a lot of their own attitude, by a lot of their own statement. I think they're tired. I don't think Pakistan, who is their chief supporter and was the real enabler of them in 1996, 1997, say, you know, all those pickup trucks they got, they had to get from someplace, and they got them from Pakistan, you know, as well as the bags of rupees to buy off. You know, when the Taliban took power in the 90s, they did a lot of it by fighting, but they did more of it by buying off the other side. And those bags of rupees came from the Pakistanis. I don't think that is going to occur like it did. You know, and the other thing, too, is that there will be American air power in the region, or that's what they say will be. So the Taliban literally just can't get on the road and drive to Kabul. But the other side of it, too, is that in the areas that the Taliban have retaking, that the Taliban have taken over from the Afghan government over the last few years, you haven't seen this mass bloodletting. You haven't seen these atrocities like the American military has been promising were going to occur. And I think that the North, Afghanistan is still so well divided that just like you saw in Iraq in 2014 in Iraq, where the Islamic State and their Sunni allies, and really I think it's a misnomer to call them all the Islamic State, but that force pushed to the edge of the Sunni areas and then they were stopped, that they were never really going to be able to take Baghdad because mm-hmm. the Shia forces were too powerful. Right. I think you're going to have the same thing in Afghanistan, where the Taliban will take those Pashtun areas completely, but then they'll be the other parts of Afghanistan will be able to stop any Taliban advance. And again, I don't think there'll be much of a Taliban advance anyway.
Man, that's great. That's the most optimistic thing. I've been dying to hear somebody tell me that, because it seems like that should actually be the basis of the peace deal. That, hey, you guys keep the South and the East, yeah. and let us keep the North, shake on it, and we'll draw a border with a pencil, not magic marker, but you'll just have essentially full autonomy within the Afghan state. And you know what? Controlling Kabul has never meant control the rest of the country anyway, so why fight like dogs over Kabul?
Kabul might as well be on the moon, I mean, as far as most of Afghanistan is concerned. And we did this. This is what occurred in Iraq in 07, 08, 09, was that the Sunnis, and this was the chief complaint of the Sunnis when I was there, and I was always in the Sunni areas, is that we've been usurped. not just in Baghdad. And I think they would have been, most Sunnis would have been okay with getting into, and they were getting into a representative form of government, as long as their areas, as long as their Sunni areas were under their control, and as long as they received their fair share of resources. And that's what, you know, continually the problem was in Iraq. Well, I mean, the problem was our invasion and occupation. Don't get me wrong on that. But what you had was that you had these Shia-dominated police and army forces led by Shia officers in the Sunni areas. And the government expelled the Sunnis, or re-expelled the Sunnis, right? That was, you know, part of our whole de-Ba'athification process. We just decided all the Sunnis were, you know, Ba'ath Party, and that they were all evil and they all had to go. So you had even Sunni school teachers were kicked off the job. And so that was part of what occurred in 07, 08, 09, was bringing the Sunnis back into the government and giving them control back of their lands. And then if that's the reason why everything falls apart after the U.S. military, and it was falling apart before the U.S. military left. It wasn't because the U.S. military left that things went to hell in Iraq. It was because the negotiated settlement between the Sunnis and the Shia that ended that civil war, again, that we caused, but that ended that civil war, fell apart. And the Shia-dominated government started taking the Sunni land and resources and abusing the people and everything else. And so in Afghanistan, if you get into a similar type of settlement, I believe, where the Pashtuns are allowed to govern themselves, they receive their fair share of the resources, I think a negotiated peace is something that can be had. I mean, they've been 10 years ago, these guys were saying it to me, members of the Taliban or their interlocutors were saying it to us, was, look, we're tired. We don't want our grandchildren to be fighting this war, but we're not going to surrender. You know, I mean, so you have to understand that, I mean, what they're fighting for is not just for some type of revolutionary system or ideological reasons. And you know, according to U.S. military intelligence, 9 out of 10 of the Taliban aren't even fighting for religious reasons. They're fighting because they don't want to be occupied. They're fighting because their communities are being brutalized by occupation and by a predatory non-representative government. So yeah, you can, those are legitimate grievances, and those are grievances that can be addressed.
Well, and I think, like you're saying here too, the policy, the doctrine of the Pakistani ISI is all important. And going back to the 90s analogy, when the Pakistanis and the Saudis were supporting the Taliban in taking Kabul and in fact continuing the war and trying to consolidate the rest of the country, which they didn't. They took the capital in 96, and they still weren't done defeating the Northern Alliance in 2001 when America invaded. But even then, it was Bill Clinton's government's policy to encourage the Pakistanis, to encourage the Taliban to go ahead and take the whole country, to not have a peaceful settlement, but to conquer their enemies and to win and create real monopoly on power there so that they could have security for their pipeline from Turkmenistan. But and I'm not saying it's about the pipeline now, but I'm saying that was the policy back in the sure. Clinton years. And so, but that goes to show, I guess, like you're saying, if it's not Pakistan's policy, Bill Clinton's policy to help the Taliban and insist that the Taliban do go that far, then they don't really, you know, maybe they could, but it would be a hell of a challenge to take that land. Maybe the Afghan National Army would break up, but Dostum and all his allies still have their militias, yeah. And there'd still be plenty to fight about. I guess that's what I'm worried about, is this insistence. And I guess I read quotes from the Taliban. Well, first of all, the Afghan government and the Americans talk as though, well, we're just going to encourage the Taliban to disarm and become a political party and participate in the democracy and the parliament in the capital city, which seems like a real bad idea when they don't seem to really want that. And you could sort of give them what they already want and leave well enough alone, sort of a thing. But there's also been quotes from the Taliban, too, saying, oh, yeah, no, don't get us wrong. Afghanistan is one country and it'll have one government and we're the only legitimate government, the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. So, and they are a bunch of suicide bomber lunatics a lot of the times. So, you know, I don't know. I guess it certainly it makes sense, at least for me, to hedge my prediction and predict the worst. But if you're telling me, I do take your point, though, that they're only as powerful as they actually are in terms of their amount of feet on the ground and guns in their hands and their ability to take that territory. And without that Pakistani help, that may be an American help that may be all important. Hey, I don't know. Why not switch sides back to the Taliban? They could do, you know, this whole time, they've needed to do an awakening with the Taliban, but there were no Al-Qaeda guys for them to turn on. But now they can just pretend the Islamic State that they created is the are the Al-Qaeda guys. And then that way we can make the Taliban into the good guys.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, like, you have that. The problem, though, is that you run against that narrative, and they hate running against their own narrative. That the Taliban, or say in Iraq, the Sunni insurgency was all composed of foreign fighters or religious zealots, and when the reality is you know, that's not the case. You know, Al Qaeda in Iraq was, gosh, 2 or 3% total of the Sunni insurgency, if that. I remember in 07 when the awakening was occurring, and I was in Western Anbar along the Euphrates Valley. River Valley, so from Ramadi West, that's what the AO, my regiment, was in. And as the awakening occurred, as the Sons of Iraq occurred, as, you know, we went from having, in my regiment's AO, we went from having 40 or 50 different, what we called ticks, troops in contact, so 40 or 50 different incidents every day, whether it was an actual attack or something, someone got shot at or whatever, 40 or 50 a day to one or two, seemingly overnight. And it was because of the awakening process, because of the, not because of counterinsurgency doctrine or General Petraeus or anything, but because we actually talked to the Sunnis and addressed their grievances. And as the Sunnis gave up the Al-Qaeda in Iraq cells in their cities and in their villages, and as our, you know, as Delta and the SEALs came in, or we send in at the regimental level, we send in our own recon units to hit these guys. You know, I mean, in cities like Haditha or Hit, you know, decent sized cities, the size of the Al-Qaeda unit, the cell, was maybe 5 guys, 6 guys total. My friend Matt Tracy was the company commander up in Haditha. And Matt and his guys, Matt was on a patrol one time, and they literally ran into the Al-Qaeda guys on the street, literally ran into them in an intersection, like T-boned one of them. And it was the Al-Qaeda. It was an accident. And it was the Al-Qaeda. And Matt and his guys wiped out the Al-Qaeda guys. And there was 3 cars of them, you know, maybe 7 or 8 guys total. And that was it. That destroyed the entire Al-Qaeda cell. In, I mean, so they were never a law enough. So the narrative that they're the ones pushing this and behind it, in that they're supporting it and their troops are the ones that fill the ranks of the insurgency, is just complete nonsense. And it's always been, you know. And if you don't address the underlying grievances, why they are fighting, you'll never have an end. I mean, so I think that's the best thing I can say to people as to why a peace process needs to be pursued, is because what's the alternative? What's the alternative? If they had listened to Scott Horton or Matt Ho back in 2009 or whatnot, you know, where would it be now? Maybe it would have fallen apart. Maybe it would have been a complete catastrophe. But would it have been a worse catastrophe than it's been for the last 10 years? I mean, I can tell you what the next 10 years are going to be like unless we change our policy. It's going to be exactly like the last 10 years have been. You know,
well,
so,
sorry, I told you so since 2001.
Okay.
you can't conquer Afghanistan. It's the size of Texas. It's landlocked, and it's got deserts like California and mountains like Colorado, and the people there like to fight. And yeah, it's on the far side of the planet, as far as you can get from here without being on your way back again. And that's it. That's all you need to know.
you can get rid of, you know, the nonsense that these guys, again, I brought them up before, David Cullen, John Nagle, these men who really pushed the counterinsurgency doctrine, who you know, Tom Ricks and all these other clowns who, you know, basically, yeah, want to be modern day Lawrence of Arabia's. The reality of counterinsurgency is the only way it works is when you subjugate the population. That's the only way it works. When you put your boot on their neck and they can't do anything, you've made them suffer so much, you've destroyed everything. That's the only way they'll stop fighting. And if the Soviets couldn't do it by killing a million Afghans, by littering Kandahar and other places with landmines and deliberately killing the children, poisoning wells, cutting down every tree in eastern Afghanistan, you know, if the Soviets couldn't subjugate those people through those tactics and that operational level of doctrine, then what makes you think that we're going to be able to do it in a nicer manner? I mean, like, it just the whole thing has never been possible. It's right. Never been possible.
This, well, and you know what? I think you hit on the fundamental dishonesty of the whole thing when you quote Petraeus saying, oh, yeah, if they take Kandahar City, that equals a 9/11 attack. He knows that that's a lie. And that just goes to show, you know, this is all about adding time to that Washington clock so that they can just keep fighting, and so that when they lose, it's not their fault. You know, just like Ryan Crocker in the Washington Post saying, oh, we can't leave now because we did such a great job winning this war back then. Well, if that's true, then how could leaving now matter? If Ryan Crocker really won the war, he can only claim his own failure if he's saying that if we leave now, then things will be, you know, a catastrophe for everyone. Well, how could that possibly be other than that Ryan Crocker designed a government that cannot possibly stand on its own, with a set of goals that it can't possibly accomplish? You know, that part didn't make it into his essay, but it was right there between the whole lines. He was the ambassador over there. That was his job, was building the state. How'd it go, Ryan? You know?
I knew a guy when I was in Afghanistan who had been there a couple times. And I remember he wanted to get a coffee mug that read, last time I was here, I was told we were winning. You know? How could it be if we were winning? And if then what happened, you know? And they want to blame it on, of course, then on Obama, on, you know, or the best thing, of course, is to blame it on, which is, you know, goes back to the Nixon decent interval, right? This way, get the American troops out, and this way we can blame it on the Vietnamese. Those little yellow people couldn't do what the American boys could, and that's why.
And I'm sorry, because Matt, that reminds me, I wanted to clarify that. I didn't mean to imply that I think, you know, buy into the worst propaganda that the Taliban will just do reprisal killings against all innocent civilians, Pol Pot thing. I know that some people say that. I wasn't really talking about that. I guess my worst case scenario was just the fight over future power was all, you know, how hard the current government will fight for what they've got and all that. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, and I think you have an example of that, of course, in the 90s, right, where the Soviet Union leaves in 89, and contrary, and this is one of the myths, you know, I talk about my essay, and I'm pretty sure you talk about in your book too, that the U.S. didn't up and leave in 89 either. We kept funding the Mujahideen all through those years until 1992, 1993. So this idea that the United States just left and everything fell apart, well, no, we kept funding them until, you know, for years after the Soviet Union had left.
Soon as they picked up their rifles in Bosnia. And you know what, too, man, with what you mentioned about Iraq, I really want to ask you about Iraq War 3.5 going on right now in Iraqi Sunnistan. And I have so many more Afghanistan questions, but I got to go. I'm so late for my next interview.
Yeah, no problem.
But
no,
I love talking with you. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Matt.
Yeah, you bet. I'm actually going to see Danny Davis for lunch.
So. Oh, great.
Yeah.
Tell him I said what's up.
Okay, we'll do. All right, hey, thanks, Scott.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. All right, you guys. Matthew, he wrote this important article. It's so good and so well done, and a million links in there and everything for you guys to learn all about this. It's the best article that's been written about Afghanistan in quite a while. It's called Time for Peace in Afghanistan and an End to the Lies. It's at antiwar.com and at Counterpunch. And again, Matthew Ho, of course, was the famous State Department whistleblower from 2009. You can read all about him in Fool's Errand. All right, y'all, thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/scotthortonshow. Oh, yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.